All veranda staterooms. Every day, a new view. Viking, offering a small ship experience on the world's oceans and a shore excursion in every port. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
After all he's been through, we're sad to see Dr. Dwight's diagnosis proven right, as usual. Poor baby Sarah departs early, and everyone's devastated.
Tomasa says Sarah's ill.
She has a cold.
Is that all?
It will be enough.
Unable to process her grief, Caroline ships off to London, leaving poor Dwight alone at Killawarren, and leaving us all alone together in sadness.
I feel that I have failed. Failed you. Myself. Her. And while I remain in this house with all of its reminders, I feel I will never come to grips with what it is that I need in order to forget.
And smug George succeeds in a less than legal return to Parliament, pushing Ross off to London as well. For a show about Cornwall, we're spending an awful lot of time in the capital city these days.
The Member of Parliament for St. Michael, Captain Howell, has surrendered. I have his assurance he will stand down at the next election.
I'm Barrett Brontes, and this is Mining Poldark, a podcast from Masterpiece. I'm joined, as usual, by Robin Ellis, the original Ross Poldark from our 1970s adaptation of Winston Graham's novels. Hi there, Robin.
Hello, Barrett. Hi.
I think we need to try and find the good parts of this episode before we dig into the sad majority.
Here we go. Breaking in Ross Poldark as a member of Parliament is proving harder than taming a young thoroughbred, which is, after all, what he is. I'm more use here than Westminster. Lord Falmouth does not agree and turns up the pressure to return. A stony-faced Ross has all his fears confirmed. During a boisterous party on the beach, Ross senses all is not well with a distracted Dwight and learns of his fears for little Sarah.
Dwight wears a rueful smile as Caroline mock complains about their cherished girl, but he keeps her in the dark and swears Ross to keep Demelza oblivious too.
Ozzy hasn't chosen the best time to ask Dwight to sign an order sectioning Morwenna for refusing to acquiesce to his conjugal demands. Even Dr. Choke finds Ozzy's wretched plan distasteful. Dwight, called for a second opinion, is contemptuous in his grief and dismisses Ozzy's claim that Morwenna must be mad. Ross later describes the mine disaster as a welcome distraction, which hardly does it justice.
And when the mine is flooded, he's able to haul Zacky's unconscious nephew to safety. There, Dwight performs mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and saves the young man's life.
As an action sequence, it's a nail-biter and a heart-stopper. The rush of water isn't just in the mine. Those emotional floodgates open up again as Dwight's predictions for little Sarah come true. Knowing what we know, it's hard to watch a proud Caroline being so tender and loving with the baby. The impact of little Sarah's death is profound and devastating. It opens up the floodgates of our tears.
Not even Rowella's foot-fleecing of Ossie or Drake's bounding along the cliff beside Rosina can undo the grief that Sarah's death brings. This is the second tiny coffin to be carried across our screens in a series that has otherwise given me so much joy. And I want to decamp to London with Caroline, or to Westminster with Ross, because the sorrow is too much to take. But, like Dwight and Demelza, we must try to make the best.
Excellent. Excellent.
So off we go into this terrible, sad episode. It's hard to even get there, but I understand that your first choice comes first. So can you tell us what it is?
What's interesting in this episode is the friendship between Ross and Dwight really is in the foreground here. And the unspoken, really, love between them is a huge strength for them through the huge emotional upheavals of this episode. And this scene really illustrates it, because Ross, on the beach, in the sort of rather boisterous party scene that had been taking place, saw, and it shows how sensitive Ross can be, he saw that Dwight was, there was something wrong with Dwight. He wasn't fully present, and it worried him. And later at the mine, Dwight is there doing his usual rounds, and Ross asks him about this.
The other day, at the beach,
You seemed out of sorts.
Yes.
You'd rather not discuss.
I'd much rather not discuss. But there'll soon be no avoiding it. Sarah will not live.
What?
She has a congenital defect of the heart.
Oh my God.
The irony. I see so many children born into poverty and squalor, yet my own child. Born into luxury, raised with all the care and attention of a princess. Such a child can be flawed.
Does Caroline know?
I can't tell her. I've thought endlessly of how to break the news gently. But I cannot. The thing must take its course. But it's simply a question of waiting for the first infection. Whether it comes this month, this year, or the next, her heart will not have the strength to meet it.
My God, Dwight. What can I do?
Not tell the mother. Not that she would say anything, but her face would betray her.
The way they do this is absolutely touching. It's a wonderful scene for both of them. I mean, Dwight does most of the talking, but Ross's reaction is extremely sensitive and very moving. And it's a sort of preface to what's going to happen, in fact. It's getting us into that kind of mood, I'm afraid. And I found it wonderful and very, very beautifully played by Aidan and Luke, I thought.
Ross is really attuned to Dwight.
He is.
I liked the way he sort of nodded, you know, they sort of nodded like, let's go talk about this over here, away from everyone. And because there's all that busy action of life at the mine. And then amidst that, this revelation is just, it's so unexpected, so staggering. And Ross is there for him. You know, what can he do? Oh, he's going to have to. And Ross doesn't question it. You think that's really a good idea? He doesn't do any of that. You know, whatever Dwight asks.
He's a listener in this scene, and it helps Dwight further not to be too much intervention because he needs to get it out. And in fact, he is very emotional and nearly in tears. In fact, he is in tears, I think. And Ross is very sensitive to that and just lets him release this emotion to some degree and senses that that would help.
It is. I agree. Well, what did you choose next? What comes next?
The next I have on my list is the actual flood. I don't really like action sequences very much, but this was just tremendously done, tremendously well done, and had a huge emotional impact, I thought, towards the end. You know, the idea that Dwight is doing this, he's saving a life when he's going to lose one of his own, as it were, is just deeply touching, I think, and says a huge amount about Dwight and his commitment.
Come on, Bobby. Come on!
Quickly!
Paul!
Touch him a blanket!
Blanket!
Someone get a blanket! Get him warm!
Paul, the salts!
Dwight, you really can work miracles.
Oh, I wish that were true. Thank you. I think the men you should be thanking are there and there.
But there's not much to say about it except that it's absolutely brilliantly filmed and beautifully played and has a great emotional impact. And action sequences don't always have that. And that's why I chose it. It's a slightly unusual choice, I think. But there we are.
You know what? I don't really like action sequences either. It's just my personal taste. And I don't like car chases. Fortunately, we don't have any of those in this series. But there, I agree with you. This one was very powerful. One of the things that makes it really work for me was that bell ringing.
Yes.
It's fantastic. They really achieve what it must have been like to live in this community and how when you heard that bell, you would drop what you were doing to go down there. You know, something is not right. Something is terribly wrong when that bell rings. So I thought that that was really successfully done. The stakes are very high. And I don't know, is part of you, well, you've made all kinds of media, you know, like, you know how things are made. Part of me was wondering, like, after, you know, on a later viewing, what are they in a tank? You know, where are they doing this? Where are these actors doing this? How are they making this?
That's a good question. When I did the Francis scene where Francis drowns, we were actually in a very famous tank in London, in Ealing Studios, which was the great film studios that created the Ealing comedies in the 40s and 50s. And we were in their tank splashing around, which was pretty bizarre and very uncomfortable. This looks so real. I must have been done in a tank. It's obviously not done for real down a mine, although we filmed down mines, and I think probably they did too. It's quite, I was going to use the word illuminating, but it's quite the opposite. You go down 200 feet, which is what we did, and you can't see a thing in front of you. And the miners used to go down 2,000 feet.
Wow.
And it just brought it home, being in that situation where really you could not see anything. You couldn't see anything.
Right.
And so anybody suffering from claustrophobia in the slightest would have been panicked.
That's me.
Yes.
Wow. That must have really made it a lot easier to play the role.
Yes.
To have had that context, or even just a fraction of, as you said, 200 feet versus 2,000.
Yes. It was hot at 200. It must have been absolutely unbearable at 2,000 feet. Can you imagine 2,000 feet? And then they go under the sea, of course, in Cornwall.
Oh, that just terrifies me. But I want to get back to this moment when Dwight is fighting to save Bobby's life. One of the other things that makes this scene so powerful for me was just knowing everything that Dwight is going through. He's left his sick baby, who he knows this will take her life, right? And he's fighting to save a life. And it's so emotional. They're saying, you know, he's gone, Dwight, but he needs to save this man. He needs to save someone, and he can't save his daughter. And so when he saves him, you just feel the balance. One life is saved and one life will be lost. It's so powerful.
It's very powerful. And there's a little positive moment for Dwight, of course, and that's great. It's a nice but horrible juxtaposition of the two. That's my second.
That's your second. And you and I share the third. So let's take a quick break before we hit that scene to hear a word from our sponsors.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central.
The scene that you and I have both chosen should surprise no one. It is a very, very hard scene to watch. It's indelible. It's one of those moments in Poldark that you'll remember forever. Oh, it's so sad. And it's the scene where Ross has come to Killawarren because he's learned that Sarah has a cold, and he knows now what that means. And he goes to give Dwight some support, and then Caroline joins them in the parlor with Sarah in her arms. And it's just so beautifully done. It's so sad. It's so hard.
Dear God. Does Caroline know?
Yes, Caroline knows. And is taking it in her stride with all the dignity and stoicism of a lady of breeding.
Caroline, will you not take some brandy?
Why? Is there something to celebrate? You know, Ross, I never wanted this wretched creature. But over the months, she has wormed her way into my affection, supplanting even poor Horace.
Do you know how long? A matter of hours? God in heaven. I should have brought him elsewhere.
No. No, I am a hard woman, and I can fend for myself. Demelza does not understand restraint and dignity. I believe Demelza would cry. And that, I fear, would undo us all.
So I think we had a little bit of a different take on this. You thought that even in these moments, there's a little bit of that upper class haughtiness, or how did you feel about that?
I did feel that in fact, as a line of personal defense, she's reverted to type in a sense, and she's gone back to her upbringing and her breeding, where the Brits are well known for their stiff upper lip. And this is a case of stiff upper lip in floods, I think. She's been taught this over a period of time as she's grown up. You know, you don't show emotion, that you get through it. It's tough, but it'll pass. And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but she suddenly, at the mention of de Melza, who comes from a completely different background and is just, you know, shows her heart on her sleeve and will definitely break down, and indeed does later on, she thinks, I cannot deal with that. That's not what it's about. I'm what it's about. It's happening to me, and I want to deal with it in my way, which is sort of understandable in a way. And it's not criticism, really, of calling her haughty. It's just that she's gone back to her tribe, I think, in a sense. How did you feel about that? What did you think?
Well, I definitely see where you're going with this. I just felt as though, and maybe it's sort of the same thing, I felt as though she, you know how she talks through Horace, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I felt like in this way, she was telling them what she needed through de Melza. She says, I'm a hard woman and can fend for myself. She's basically saying to them, don't cry. I need you to not cry, because that will destroy me, that I need to hold on as hard as I can, not to feel my emotions, not to cry. So that's what I thought was going on there. I think that she's almost complimenting de Melza in a way, but she's saying that what she needs from them is to bottle it up and not make her cry. That's what she needs. It's as though the de Melza were Horace here.
You're absolutely right that that's what she needs. It may just be a matter of words, but the use of dignity somehow and saying that de Melza doesn't know about dignity. I mean, de Melza has a natural dignity, I think.
Yes, she does.
So, I mean, I don't blame Caroline for that, but it hit a sort of spot with me when she said that. But I totally agree with you about what Caroline needs, and Caroline is going to do what she needs. I mean, she's determined. She thinks this is her only way of saving herself, really, is to remove herself and be in a different place, which is not so exposing. London is a very different atmosphere with lots of people, and she can, I mean, it's significant that she throws parties with 100 guests and things, that she gets lost in the crowd, as it were.
I thought that it was an incredible scene. And for me, when she said that, I was like, okay, Caroline, I won't cry.
Well,
I won't cry. I don't want to be the thing that undoes us all. I'm going to hold it together. But of course I couldn't. I had to cry. And I can't see another small coffin. It's just awful. It's terrible.
It was raining too this time. I don't think it was raining last time.
I know. Of course it was.
Pouring with rain. And Caroline's face was just extraordinary. I mean, this absolutely...
Yeah. And Dwight, too.
Dwight,
oh, Dwight.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
You know, he has to perform for Caroline because he loves her so much. He just wants to do, but he needs to grieve. And for him to just like sob in Ross's arms, oh, it was so good.
Absolutely. In fact, there's not much to say about it except that it was so good,
yeah.
Really. I mean, that's right. I mean, it was a complete instinctive thing that they found each other in a way. And Dwight's reaction is very emotional. It's very good to see the difference between Ross and Dwight. You know, he is capable.
Oh, he is. So my next scene is sort of the result of what happened. It is when Caroline goes to Dwight and tells him that she's leaving him for London. Oh, God. As if Dwight isn't suffering enough. Now he's going to lose her. I just liked this scene. Well, I loved the way she came through that arch in the hedge. You know, he's sitting there trying to lose himself in a book, and he's all alone, and he's so isolated in his grief. And so she comes to him, and we're thinking maybe something good will happen here, but it's worse than we could imagine.
My love, I've been thinking, are we not taking all this too much to heart? Children die every day, and the fact that this one was ours and we esteemed it above all others shows a miserable lack of proportion. Besides, I was never meant to be a mother.
You know that is nonsense. You've been an excellent one, and I hope we'll be so again.
No, that I cannot do. Dwight, I want to leave you.
What do you mean?
Not forever, but I feel that I have failed. Failed you. Myself. Her. And while I remain in this house with all of its reminders, I feel I will never come to grips with what it is that I need in order to forget.
You cannot wish that.
Not her. The lack of her. The loss of her.
Where will you go?
To London. For a month or so.
May I not come with you?
And abandon your patience.
If it were just a month.
It will not be just a month.
It seemed so final somehow. There was no qualification to that. It was quite a shock, wasn't it, the first time she said that. I said, what? Yes, she's leaving? No.
Yeah.
I mean, for good, I thought, you know, that was the implication. But of course, that was not going to be true. But nevertheless, she seemed very determined.
One of the things I liked about this is Caroline often, she has that sort of pretense of being somewhat superficial, right? And not deep. But here, she is dead serious and she is honest. I mean, she's usually not honest. You know, she'll divert. But here she's very, very direct with him. And it seemed this directness attests to how serious this situation is. And courageous for her to say these things to him. She's really thought a lot about it, why she needs to leave. And he loves her. He's just going to let her go because it's what she needs.
He understands her. And in fact, it's for these qualities that he's fallen in love with her, I think. I mean, her difference, her sureness, her intelligence, her qualities, these qualities you've just run through are why they're together and why he fell in love with her. And in a way, the reverse, you know, she sees these very quite unusual qualities in Dwight, you know. They're two unusual people who found each other, and it's right. It's a completely right coupling. And that's what makes this so difficult to watch.
So difficult. Oh. So my third scene was just, I wanted to get your opinion about this scene. I found this scene to be so odd. I don't know what Ross is thinking here, but over at Nampara, everyone is sort of playing with the kids, and Dwight is just very quietly standing there aside with this sad look on his face. And Ross notices and says, want to go get some air? Let's go for a walk.
Everyone has their trials and tribulations. It's how one chooses to respond.
How do you respond?
You know, by gritting my teeth in the day and weeping into my pillow at night. Caroline, meanwhile, prefers horses, assemblies, and gowns. You?
Oh, you've seen me. Frenzied, back-breaking, all-consuming activity. Doing, never dwelling. Sometimes I think I've welcomed this mind disaster. It's been a useful distraction.
And how long will this distraction continue?
Until I find a reason for it to stop.
Enemy territory.
And typical of everything he stands for. George is neglecting his defenses. How careless of him.
Ross.
You think I'm the only one who objects to these barricades?
No, but I think you have particular grievances which others do not.
It's not my duty. As an elected member of Parliament, to be the mouthpiece of my constituents.
The mouthpiece, perhaps, but the hand?
Or the foot?
Why is he doing this when Dwight needs him to behave differently right now? Or do you think he thinks that this is just the thing that's going to make Dwight feel better, distract him, put a smile on his face? I don't know. What's going on with Ross here?
Ross is in a state about having to go back to Westminster. He knows he's got a responsibility to pursue the cause that he holds so dear, which is the poor and looking after them and finding ways of making their lives better. But the thought of going away from Demelza, I mean, and going back to the very different place, which is Westminster and the House of Commons, is quite frightening to him. And it's sort of a protest, which is fueled also by this very high emotion that he's feeling about the death of little Sarah and how it reminds him of the death of Julia. All those things are sort of tied up into a kind of emotional bomb, I think. And anything that comes handy is quite handy for kicking, you know. I mean, he's not going to kick Dwight or punch him or anything because he loves him. But come against a post that's been put up by George reminds him of all that kind of baggage. And the thing is about to fall down anyway, so it's not as though he's destroying it. He's just sort of helping it on its way. And it's a perfect thing to do. But I do agree with you that it is a slightly odd, self-centered moment, which doesn't quite fit comfortably.
I understand that he really does have a lot of pressure, and he hasn't taken the mantle of his role as MP lightly. He's really serious about it, and he's been trying to make a difference and do the job he's been sent there to do, and he's encountered nothing but resistance, really. And now Falmouth is mad at him, but there's a time and a place. And remember back when Demelza sort of picked a fight a little bit with Ross when he had just found out that Aunt Agatha died. Mm-hmm. Remember that back on the beach? This is the same thing. Like, just read the room, you know?
Yeah, control yourself. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you were right in your instinct to, you know, he was doing this because he knew that Dwight didn't have that kind of physical outlet, you know, for his emotions. So maybe he was doing a bit for his friend.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'd have to ask him, but he's not around. Really.
No, we can't. That's right. We can't ask him. We'll just have to do our best to understand. So I don't mean to end with a moment that I didn't think was heroic, when I think that Ross was a good hero this episode. What would you give him?
Oh, I'd definitely give him a 9 because he did this incredible rescue in the mine, which was extremely brave. But also his whole attitude to Dwight and to Caroline in this terrible, tragic time. And even the, you know, the scene on the beach between when they have a little kind of argument, Demelza and Ross, you know, the same old thing comes up. But it's really in a very understandable context of what's gone before. It's almost kind of necessary. They've got to go through this, you know.
Do we, though?
No, do we? Good question.
I like, what did you call it? A now familiar spat, right?
Yeah, spat. Yes, a spat.
All too familiar. Yeah.
So what do you give him?
I'll give him a 9 also.
You give him a 9. Okay, yeah, I think he's a 9er in this one, certainly, yeah.
He's doing a good job this season.
He has, yes. This reconstruction is suiting him.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's maturing, our hero.
He is. He is.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. This has been, you've been a wonderful partner as we walk through the Valley of Death.
And you too, Barrett, as usual. It's been a pleasure. Bye for now.
For a dastardly villain, George's Uncle Carrie has some of the funniest lines on the series. Actor Pip Torrens has loved playing the character we all love to hate, and he spoke with my colleague, Jace Lacob, on our companion podcast, Masterpiece Studio, about the experience.
What's interesting to me is that George has become a sort of proper English gentleman. Mm. He looks the part, but more importantly, he sounds the part, whereas Carrie has held on to his natural Cornish accent. Does that accent underpin the class distinctions between uncle and nephew?
I think it does, yes. And it's fun sometimes. I want my accent to be noticeable without being extreme. And you're right, there's a very interesting divide in the show. I mean, like Demelza, for example, has her accent and she keeps to that. And that's important because she's a local girl and Ross sort of rescued her from what might have been a terrible life otherwise. But yes, it's always there. And I like to think that, and the way that Jack and I like to play it is, you know, that Carrie does great on George sometimes. It's so beautifully written by Debbie Horsfield that she puts in scenes where, you know, Carrie's needling George a bit about, you know, his pretensions and therefore tacitly reminding him where he's come from.
How difficult is it to achieve and maintain that perfect Cornish accent?
Well, that presupposes that I am capable of a perfect Cornish accent. I think I try not to think about the perfection of the accent because I think also that Carrie probably isn't speaking unadulterated pure Cornish, that he has sort of progressed a little way, but it's something you need to look at and work at and maybe change a few words, talk to the writers, talk to the script consultants and see what they think. I try not to overdo it. That's always my note to myself. And he's a growler, Carey. He's a lurker and a growler. So I just try to sort of visualize him as doing those things and have it come out in the quality of the voice rather than thinking about the actual specifics of the accent.
Is that his primary motivation within the series, to sort of scheme? Is he the consummate
schemer? Oh, yeah, he's a schemer, and he's very happy with the way that the Warlegan Bank evolves through the series into becoming kind of powerhouse. I think his wariness is about George getting into politics too much. Carey's interested in power, but I don't think he's interested in political power. Specifically, he's interested in just social power. Financial power is what it comes down to.
George and Carey are characters that we love to hate. Why do you feel that they make such perfect allies?
They have a kind of bickering thing going, I think, or there's a nice disconnect between them, so that although, you know, as I've said, Carey regards George as his protege, for George to go on and get what George wants, he has to acquire many of the characteristics of people that they both despise, although George despises these people less and less as he becomes one of them. You know, he meets the great lords and politicians of the age. And I think what's been really enjoyable and why it's so great to be acting with Jack Farthing, who's just so clever and nuanced in his performance, is that we get lovely little sort of notes between us about how, yeah, we're on the same side, but we don't necessarily agree on the way things should proceed. And I think that's something that's been really nicely developed and allowed to grow by Debbie Horsfield.
Do you see Carey as the devil sitting on George's shoulder?
Slightly, yes. And in the original books, as Debbie described it to me, it was, you know, Carey's character was very much the bad angel on one shoulder, whereas the father, George's father, was rather more reasonable. So, yeah, no, I like it that he's the devil's advocate in any situation. But what's interesting is increasingly you see situations where George outdoes the devil's advocate. So I don't know what the simile would be. He becomes the pupil outdoes the teacher or whatever.
That was Poldark star Pip Torrens in an interview with my colleague Jace Lacob on our companion podcast, Masterpiece Studio. You can hear the rest of the conversation and many more interviews with most of the Poldark cast at pbs.org/masterpiece studio or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Next, Ossie Whitworth meets a surprise foe.
Reverend Whitworth, what do you want?
This is what I want.
We'll get the details next time on Mining Poldark. And you can join us in our rewatching adventure here on Mining Poldark by watching the entire series on PBS Passport, a new member benefit from your local PBS station. You can watch select Masterpiece titles like Poldark, Downton Abbey, or Victoria as part of the Passport experience. To learn more, visit pbs.org/getpassport. You can also follow along with us on the PBS Masterpiece Prime video channel, available as an add-on service to your Amazon Prime membership. Mining Poldark is hosted by me, Barrett Brontes, with co-host Robin Ellis. We're produced by Nick Anderson, with help from Robin Bissett. Meredith Wheeler is our field producer. Tina Toby Mack is our sound designer. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Poldark is a Mammoth Screen production for BBC, co-produced with Masterpiece.
Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.